Welcome back to term four. Last term of the year. It's going to be a shorter series. That's the Jewish calendar's fault because all the festivals were in a little bit later this year. And I kind of feel guilty we didn't start last Thursday, but to be very honest with you, after the 2-month marathon of Elul and Tishrei, I was a kind of a mess last week. So, thank you, Rona. That's good. Okay, so I hope everyone had a meaningful. Okay, so I just want to first of all give a little introduction to this series called Emotional Wellness, based on this book, which has just recently been published, Letters for Life. I'll explain it as we go along. But as we've talked about many times, the human being is divided into three layers, meaning the conscious part of the human being operates on three layers, what we call seichel, cognition, intellect, midot, emotion, feelings, and then behavior, how we speak, how we talk, how we act, and so on. And the most powerful and the most complicated layer of the human being is our emotions. Why? As we've talked about many times, because really the personality of the person, the Talmud talks about this as well, the personality of the person, the identity of the person almost, who the person is, comes out in their emotional responses. Not so much the intellectual ideas. You can't really tell, a little bit you could, but you can't tell a person, you can't tell the character of a person by what they say or what they explain or the ideas that they have. You can't even tell a person by the action that they have, by the behavior that we have. You can tell a little bit. I mean, if a person is a kind person, you can tell, but it doesn't mean that they are intrinsically kind. In other words, it could be they worked on themselves and they're forcing themselves to do certain things for whatever reason. It could be sincere altruistic reasons or it can be manipulative reasons, whatever the case is, but the person doesn't necessarily come out, the personality of the person doesn't necessarily come out in what they think in terms of their ideas or their behavior. But where you can tell a person is by the emotional responses, right? How they respond emotionally to other people. Basically, the definition of emotions, as we've talked about many times, there are many definitions, but in terms of the Kabbalistic definition of midot, of emotions, is how we respond to the world outside us, how we relate to the things, experiences, people, events, other people, families, and so on that are around us. So we can tell how a person reacts. Do they have empathy? Don't they have empathy? Are they happy? Are they sad? Are they a loving person, a hateful person? Are they very emotional and high-strung, or they just emotionally have emotional deficits and just lacking emotion, and so on and so forth, right? Now, in more modern literature, we've discussed this a bit, but I'm going to expand on it today. There's been an incredible awareness and importance of emotional health and emotional regulation. This was preceded by another sort of very strong awareness, which came out a while ago, the emergence of the importance of EQ versus IQ. EQ, many definitions, but one of the definitions would be the ability to understand. I'm just reading a definition that I saw, to understand, use and manage our own emotions in positive ways to relieve stress, communicate effectively, empathize with others, overcome challenges and diffuse conflict and so on, right? By the way, there's lots of different types of intelligence. They talk about MQ today, which is moral intelligence, the ability to tell wrong from right, BQ, body intelligence, all kinds of different things. But EQ is important and sometimes thought to be much more important even than IQ, right? Successful people, happiness and all of these things come more from EQ than they do from IQ, very often. And because of that, what's happened in the last number of years, an incredible emphasis on what they call emotional regulation training, right? This is something that is very popular in schools, teaching kids how to identify their emotions with skills, to have emotional awareness, to regulate and manage their own emotions, to harness emotions, and so on. Now, these are important skills. Some of you have heard me a few times know what I'm about to say. They are important skills, and the movement is coming from a good space. But, and why is it coming from a good space? Because, as we said before, it seems true and it seems obvious that happiness, success, healthy relationships, inner calmness, right, and just general good living comes from being healthy emotionally. Emotional wellness, as the topic says. However, the question is it working? Is it working? All this emotional awareness and emotional training, is it working? I think the answer is no, it's not working. Not because the skills are so bad. Why I say it's not working, I'm not basing this on my own anecdotal thinking. It's been now documented. There's more anxiety, there's more internal unrest, there's more inner conflict, there's more less calmness, there's less empathy, there's so many unhealthy relationships, and it doesn't seem to be working very well. Why is that? Because something's missing, right? Something's missing from the whole equation. There's just introductions where I want to go to and give a bit of an introduction to the book that we're going to use. And part of what's missing is that although some of these skills are true, and of course one needs to be in tune with their emotions, and as we've mentioned so many times, the Torah tells us, for example, in the laws of grief, we have the laws of Shiva and the whole process, because it's important to give expression to the emotions that we're feeling, and it's a healthy thing to do, and so on and so forth. But what's obviously, as we know, what's happened is that there's become such a focus on this awareness and identification and the channeling and the acceptance of our own emotions that we've slid into a over-obsession of self. That's what's happening. People are very, very involved with self, right? Ruminating on self, as we once talked about, busy with oneself. And by the way, this is not just about this program. The truth is, this is even when there's a modality and there's an approach to healing which is really legitimate and really critical and really important. One of the side effects of going in, it has side effects, everything, even good things have side effects, right? Because, you know, in Kabbalistically, we learn that since Adam, we just read in the parasha a few weeks ago about Adam and Eve with the first sin, right? So Kabbalah tells us that from the first sin, there's no good without bad, there's no bad without good. Meaning God created the world with a bit of bad, but the bad was very separate from the good. Very clear cut, what was good, what was bad. But since the Chet Eitz Hadas, of course, it's still good and bad, but a lot of times it's mixed. There's no good without bad, and no bad without good. It's just an interesting thing. So even when something's important and really healthy, for the most part, it's still going to have side effects. And one of the side effects with any modality of healing is the involvement with self. It's a very interesting thing. I've seen this up front, where people involve themselves and engage in approaches of healing which are really important. I'll give you an example, like for addiction. People engaging in the 12-step program, which, by the way, the 12-step program is an amazing program. Billions of people have been helped for all sorts of different types of addictions. It's one of the most effective programs ever developed, right? You know, nowadays it gets questioned a little bit, but it's for the most part, it's really fantastic. And yet we do find sometimes people who get involved in it become a little bit over self-absorbed because they're busy with themselves. It's just it's a natural outcome. They have to go to three or four meetings a week initially. They become very aware of themselves because they have to do a reflection, right? I mean, even we have this in Yiddishkeit, even where we talked about the month of Elul, where we have to do a cheshbon ha-nefesh, we have to do a reflection for the year gone by. But we are cautioned not to do this every day, because every day we shouldn't be so busy with ourselves. We just be busy with getting on with the job and doing what God wants from us. But of course, we have to reflect. So we're given certain times, certain ways, certain structures of how to do it in an effective way, right? So it's just the fact that every time we, personal growth, we talk about personal growth, we've been doing that for the last 15 years every Thursday morning, right? But, and I'm sure the side effect hasn't happened, but because we talk a lot about selflessness. But the truth is you meet people who are very into reading self-help books and self-growth books and personal growth, personal development, and then they sometimes are the most self-centered people. Again, no one here, because we talk about selflessness all the time as well, right? But except for me, maybe. But I'm saying, but other than that, no one, right? But it is a possible side effect, because when you get busy with yourself, self is always a problem. Overemphasis on self is always a problem, right? You know, I listened to a TED talk about this just a couple of days ago. There's a woman by the name of Ramona Hacker. She's an author of the book Six Steps to Improve Emotional Intelligence, right? And to some, it's a whole book and a whole TED talk, but essentially your six steps are you've got to acknowledge your own emotions and talk about them, analyze your own emotions and distinguish between the different ones. So like, no, you know, what am I feeling now? Is it love? Is it hate? Is it frustration? Is it anger? Is it something else? Is it this, right? You've got to accept all of your emotions, which I don't agree with altogether, because some emotions are toxic and you shouldn't accept them. You should acknowledge them, but you need to work on moving them on. You can do all this through journaling, she says, write it down. Then you've got to reflect on emotions and their origin. That's right. Also very important, apparently. You've got to now, why am I feeling sad? Why am I feeling angry? Because, you know, it's got to do with my third grade teacher or the way my parents parented me or whatever the case is. Where is it coming from? Why do I? I mean, it could be just because that's where you're born. Every person is born with an emotional deficit. That's what the Talmud tells us. We all have areas of our personality that are weak. It's just a fact, right? Then at 5, you've got to handle them, and then you've got to handle the emotions of others. Fine, all sounds good. But if you read through this, it's all about me. In other words, if you do this, you do this properly, you're busy half the day with yourself. You'll always be thinking about yourself and why, and where does it come from, and okay, right? And that ultimately cannot work, and it cannot bring happiness, and it cannot bring calmness, and it cannot bring wellness or well-being. Because, as we said before, my emotions are actually me. It's my personality. And when we obsess and ruminate with ourselves, we become more trapped in ourselves. Right? Important idea. We become trapped in ourselves. And trapped in ourselves means that we are now limited and we're constrained. Because the self of every human being is very finite. We are very finite people. We all have our own Egypt, as we've talked about many times. We all have our own Mitzrayim. We all have our own limitations. We all have our things that we're stuck and locked in and part of personal growth and part of growing into a healthy human being, an improved human being, and a better human being, and a refined human being, is about going beyond ourselves. To go beyond yourself, you cannot be trapped in yourself the whole time. Of course, you've got to deal with yourself. You've got to acknowledge what your limitations are. You've got to acknowledge where you need fixing, and that's what the cheshbon is all about, and so on. But you can't obsess with yourself the entire time. It's not about us. It's about going beyond us. And that needs other methods and other strategies. So that follows into understand what this book is about that I'm about to go through, partly at least. So the book is I'll just give you a little bit of introduction. It's called Letters of Life. It's guidance for emotional wellness. It's actually based on it's put together by a guy called Levi Shmatkin, but it's based on correspondence and letters from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Now, let me just explain. The Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote hundreds of thousands of letters to people, gave hundreds of thousands of talks, and had personal interaction with hundreds of thousands of people, right? Many of them were about mental health. Many of them were about emotional wellness. Many about depression, about all sorts of... There's like hundreds and hundreds of volumes of the Rebbe's talks and Rebbe's letters. And many of them deal... I mean, obviously, a lot of them deal with direct Yiddishkeit thing, mitzvahs and Torah and advice and all kinds of things. But many of them actually deal with mental health issues, with wellness issues, well-being issues, and so on and so on. Joy, happiness, so many, right? And there's been books put out in the past in English, sort of translating or putting together a lot of these letters, which are very, very fascinating. But what this book does, which I liked, which is why I'm using it, is this book actually takes it and divides it into a few topics and collects letters in different places, stories of people, and so on, and puts them into sort of each chapter on their own, and that's why it's just a very beautiful way to read through these things. And what I want to do is, this time, we have all different kinds of books that we go through, but this time I picked this book. It came out recently when I was in New York. I picked it up last time. And today we're going to do chapter one, but of course we're going to elaborate and bring from other places, other sources, and so on and so forth. And you'll see as we go along, especially the first chapter, but I think this runs through the whole book, that one of the common themes that the Rebbe was not very fond of is being obsessed with self. And that comes through very, very clearly. And that's the missing link of what's happening nowadays. Right? Now, I always make this disclaimer, but I'm going to do it again, because I don't want people to think that therapy is not important. I don't want people to think that healing isn't important. Healing is important, and especially when there's clinical, you know, we've talked about depression with a small d and of course with a big d, and it depends how deep it is, it depends how clinical it is. And there are some times that it's absolutely clear that people need to have professional intervention, and if they do, they should. Not only should, but have to, and it's obligatory, really. It's part of health, and need to engage in effective and well-researched approaches to therapy and healing from trauma, and all these kind of things are all true, and I'm not here at all to undermine that. But at the same time, to be aware of the when we need it, number one, and number two, to be aware of the side effects and how we sort of balance that. So, the chapter one starts with an interesting story that started in 1971. And this had to do with an astronomer who discovered the concept of a black hole, right? They talk about the black hole. It's a little story. He was watching a star through an observatory in Canada, a massive object which is 1,600 light years away. I'm not going to be able to explain it very well because it's not my area of expertise at all. But the bottom line is that it remained invisible and it wasn't generating light. And it was extremely heavy, and therefore the mass was sort of holding down everything that it had, including its own light. It says, an object with a mass so dense that nothing, not even its own light, could be escape its gravitation pull. So it was pulling back in that way. At that time, there was a guy called Professor Hermann Bronnevier. I met him a few times. He was a very interesting fellow. He was a scientist in Russia. He was a Russian, completely secular scientist under the communist rule. And somehow, when he was there, discovered Yiddishkeit, and he remained a scientist, an incredible scientist, and became a Hasidic Jew, eventually was able to get out of Russia, and had tremendous, tremendous relationship with the Rebbe, because the Rebbe himself was a scientist, as you probably know, and there had a lot of conversation, a lot of correspondence. So a few years after that discovery, he was a respected physicist in the field of solar energy, and he was going to give a presentation on some scientific thing. And the Rebbe asked him to please include in his presentation a life lesson that can be learned from the sun and black holes. This is, of course, in line with something we've talked about many times. The Baal Shem Tov would say that everything we encounter and everything we learn has a lesson in life, because nothing is by chance, everything is by divine providence. And therefore, if there's a concept, if there's a new discovery, besides its use in terms of scientific and physics knowledge, there also has to be a lesson that we can learn from it. And he went on to explain the following. He said, I'll quote this from the book. He says like this. He says, the black hole turns everything inward, drawing all of its energy towards itself. The sun, on the other hand, radiates its energy outward, illuminating other beings in the solar system. If the sun heated only its own mass, who would pay any attention to it? It's upon us to emulate the sun's example and turn our energy outward. We must make an effort to radiate our light and warmth to others. So the reason that the black hole is the black hole is because it absorbs its own light and it doesn't radiate outwards, right? As opposed to the sun that does. So this goes into sort of a whole idea in general, which is a foundational concept in the way the world was created. And that is that Kabbalah teaches us, as we know, that the entire cosmic order is structured according to a system called sun and moon. Right. By the way, it's very interesting. You know, we've talked about this before, but our calendar, the Jewish calendar, is a lunar calendar, right? Is it? No, it's not. It's partly a lunar calendar. You know that? Yeah. Meaning our months are lunar cycles, but it's only a partly lunar calendar, different to the Muslims. Our system of calendar is a hybrid. It's a combination of both sun and moon because the festivals have to be according to the sun, right? So our calendar of festivals is solar. So in the northern hemisphere, that is, because that's where Israel is, Pesach must always be in the spring. Shavuot must be the festival of harvest. It's very agricultural. Sukkot is the festival of the ingatherings and so on, which is why 12 months of a lunar calendar only makes up like 354 days roughly, whereas a solar calendar is 365 days, I'm talking in general terms, of course. And that's why every few years we have what's called a leap year. So in case you want to know why this year Rosh Hashanah was in October, not September, that's why. Because this year was a leap year. It was one of those years that we have to... It goes by a 19-year cycle. There are seven leap years. Just telling you a fun fact. There are seven leap years in a 19-year cycle. And this year was one of them. And that's why I pushed everything late. That's why everything's late. Hanukkah's late this year. Everything's late, right? Because we're now ahead a little bit. It balances out after 19 years. That's why. Do you know that? That's why on your 19th birthday, your Hebrew birthday and your English birthday and your real birthday, which is the Hebrew birthday, is on the same day, right? Some of us a day off because of February. Because that's also got to do with English leap year. So it could be a day off, but it's all around the same time. Because every 19 years, yeah. By the way, just to revisit the birthday issue, it's got totally nothing to do with what we're talking about. But all those who need to know the Hebrew birthday, please tell me afterwards and I can work it out for you very quickly. Okay, so why is that? So why is the Torah so focused that we should have sun and moon come together? Because that is the way the world was structured. The world was structured that you have to give and you have to receive. Again, receiving doesn't mean to be needy. Receiving means to be able to take from others to facilitate giving. Right? Meaning that every single one of us have to be a sun and a moon. That's how it works. Because giving doesn't only mean financial giving. Giving can be any type of giving, right? Because every person is a sun. Every person has to be able to have things. Not has to be able. Everyone has. Every person has things that others don't. It could be emotional intelligence. It could be a skill. It could be an idea. It could be anything. It could be an opportunity to help out when others are struggling. Whatever the case is. So we all have the capacity and the need and the necessity of being a sun. But in order for that to happen, there also has to be mekabel. There has to be a moon. The moon doesn't have its light of its own. The moon receives the light from the sun and radiates its sun, right? So God created the world in a way where he told us that the calendar should be a system which combines moon and sun, right? Because it combines the concept of giving and receiving. We've talked about this before. That's why not only giving is so important, and giving is very important. It's the only way we can go beyond ourselves, right? Is to give to others and to help others. But we also have to know that sometimes that means also we have to know when to reach out and ask for help, because we cannot be giving without receiving. That's why the moon is an important part, right? But it's only an important part. The moon doesn't have any of its own light because it receives the light from the sun. In other words, it facilitates the sun's giving. That's what it is, right? So the emphasis here is really on giving. It's all about the idea to give. As the verse tells us, Olam Chesed Yibaneh. That when the world was created, it was based on kindness. That's why the 6 days of creation correspond to the six emotions, emotional responses that we have, which is Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, and so on. We talked about these six or seven sfirot. We talked about the idea of Chesed being the first one. Sunday corresponds to Chesed, the first day of creation, which was the day that God created light that would give, that would illuminate the world. That's the first day of creation, because Alam Chesed Yibaneh, because everything in the world is based on the concept of giving. Even receiving is based on the concept of giving. It's there to facilitate the idea of giving, right? The Rebbe once wrote to a college student, he says, it will clearly reveal that the universe we live in is ordered in a system of give and take. And the personal universe of the individual, the microcosm, must likewise conform to the system of reciprocal relationship. Consequently, when one disrupts or distorts the system by thinking only of their own needs, it must necessarily bring about a distortion in one's immediate surroundings and especially in one's inner life. In other words, built into who we are is the need to give, is the necessity to give. That's who we are. That's our DNA. And therefore, self-absorption, which eliminates or removes or diminishes the concept of giving, becomes a process where we become unhappy because we're distorting and we're damaging our own world system. The world can only function properly if there's a sun and the moon and the combination of both. If we take away the sun aspect, that we don't radiate our light outwards, we mess up our own internal system and we create a black hole. And a black hole, of course, is the image and the symbolism of sadness, of withdrawnness, of depression, and so on and so forth. So giving and going beyond ourselves, giving outwards, becoming a sun, is an antidote to emotional distortion or irregulation. It actually creates wellness and health. There was a guy called, I think it was in the 90s, his name was Mark Wilson. Mark Wilson was an activist, a columnist. He was also a rabbi in North Carolina. And he had a rough life. He had a mental health issue, I think it was bipolar. I looked it up, I Googled it, and he wrote about it himself. He went through a very grim period where his second marriage failed and his career as a congregational rabbi collapsed. And he really went to what he called a black hole of depression. After a while, just spending time in bed and just writing articles and about his own predicaments and so on, it was the early 1990s, and someone advised him, why don't you go and see the Lubavitcher Rebbe? So that a brief, the Rebbe wasn't taking long audiences in those years. It was, I was there those years, I remember them. You could have very brief encounters with the Rebbe by the famous Sunday dollars, where the Rebbe would give out, the Rebbe was, again, very into the idea of giving. So he had this whole practice that every Sunday there would be long lines of people that would come and he would give them a dollar. The idea was to take the dollar and to give it to charity, right? To foster the concept of giving. This was a big theme by him. But also was the opportunity that if you wanted to quickly ask a question, you could say something or ask for a bracha, or like very quickly. It was very tough because the secretaries were very hard, very loyal. And they would, I mean, there were thousands of people and it could take, I mean, it used to be take sometimes 6 hours at a time. But, and if everyone would start schmoozing, it would never end, right? So that was their job. They didn't always seem so nice, but they were doing their job, which was at least to hustle people on. So this Mark, what did I say his name was? Mark Wilson. So he came and he quickly shared his predicament with the Rebbe and he told him that his congregational rabbi career had collapsed and he was really in a black hole. So the Rebbe told him like this. He said, a devoted layperson, because now he was a layperson, he wasn't a rabbi, can do incalculably more good than a rabbi. You should teach something, perhaps Talmud, if it's only to one or two people in your living room. As he told him to do. So you should start a shir. And not being a rabbi could be even more effective, because, you know, a rabbi, that's his pay to do. But like, right? So a year passed and he didn't listen. It was actually, it was just a dismal dark year. And eventually, I guess, people sort of, he would just write about depression and he was just really just completely dysfunctional. Finally, at the urging of a friend, story goes, he started acting on the Rebbe's advice and he started leading a small class in Talmud, in Gemara. And he said it was then that his soundness and self-respect was restored. And the Rebbe obviously understood that to heal from depression, I needed to start giving to others. He wrote in an article, The Power of Giving. That in that particular case, that act of giving actually took him away from himself. When he was less connected to himself and obsession with self, he started to self-respect more. That's how it goes, right? The less you think about yourself, the more you have self-respect. And the more you actually understand the importance of being connected to others and giving to others and so on and so forth. And that's when he started to heal. So the power of giving. There was a person I knew, his name was Rabbi Yunik. He was a chassid of the Rebbe, a very close chassid. And he came from Russia as a child. As a young man. And he was, he came in the time of the previous Rebbe, and he was very connected to the previous Rebbe. Then the previous Rebbe passed away. And he was very broken, and he had a rough time. And he had a discussion with the Rebbe about this, which no one ever knew about. And only later, after he passed away, which was much, much later, talking about the 90s, or I think even later than that, they found his diaries, this Rabbi Yunik. And one of them, he writes about an encounter, about a private audience he had with the Lubavitcher Rebbe and the discussion that took place. He writes, like, I'm going to quote it because it's beautifully written. He says like this, I relayed that while I have good periods, other times I find myself being down over my spiritual state of being. You know, some people are worried about different things. He was worried about his spiritual state of being. He didn't think it was good enough. He didn't think he was good enough. He didn't think that he was doing the right thing. So the Rebbe responded like this. He told him a few things. And then he says that sometimes when there's spiritual changes, it makes changes within a human being. And then the Rebbe went up to say this following, which is amazing. I think it's amazing. This took place like in the 1950s. And if the Rebbe said this then, I wonder what we can think now. He said like this. This is a problem of many of our young people. They analyze themselves too much. It is necessary to think about others for at least an hour a day. This was one of his ideas, meaning my father-in-law's ideas, he said, the previous Rebbe's ideas. If you want to be connected to him, you have to do it, right? When a thought about your state enters your mind and you see that it is disturbing you from what you should be doing, increases a feeling of dejection, etc., you should push that thought away. If you do not have a way to dispel the depressing thought because you're not in a good state, and so you have reason to be dejected, you should remind yourself of the obligation to help others. Think about others and how you can make things better for them. That was his advice. He took that advice. He wasn't a depressed person at all. I knew him. He was a quiet person. He was a very beautiful person. And obviously, that encounter had a tremendous effect on him. And that's obviously, he took it to heart. And that's what he did. And he was okay. I chose something a few days ago. It's not in the book, but I'll share it with you. It's about someone. I'll just give you a bit of context. When, you know, the Rebbe used to answer letters. Not, people were writing things. And sometimes he would send a letter, but sometimes he wouldn't. I got many answers from the Rebbe about different things that I should do. And the way the Rebbe would answer them is you'd send in a letter, and then like in a couple of days later, you go to the secretary and you'd ask if there's an answer, and sometimes they would show you the answer. And the answer was never, the Rebbe never wrote a separate answer. What he would do is he would often use phrases from your own letter. And like, well, let's say you asked, should I do this or this? They would circle the one, then he would say yes, you know, that kind of thing, right? A lot of things. So once a person that wrote a letter like this, that he said he's in a state of depression, and he wrote like this. He said, I would like the Rebbe's help. I wake up each day sad and anxious. I can't concentrate. I find it hard to pray. I feel that life has lost its joy and pointless. I need help. So the Rebbe wrote a reply without using any words. He just circled the first word of every sentence, which was I, and sent it back to him. You know, it was, stop being so worried about I. Right? It was a beautiful way of like, I know a lot about the Rebbe's answers, and it was very typical, such a thing, right? Like, he probably circled all the I's and probably put a question mark, exclamation mark, or something like that. But basically, that was the answer, the circling of all the I's. And that's the truth, right? That's what I say. Now, again, obviously we need healing. Thinking about others is not always the answer, the only answer, but it's a very, very fundamental thing. Especially in a preventative way. Because when we get too involved with the I, which sadly to say we live in a society that does that quite well, when we get so involved in the I, we decrease happiness, we decrease inner calmness, we decrease light, we decrease wellness. The only way to really heal is to go beyond ourselves. It's almost counterintuitive. The only way to have a healthy self is not to think about that self too much, right? You know, it's like I read somewhere that there was a doctor who did a tremendous amount of research into the anatomy of the leg or something. And I don't know exactly what it was. And he shared with a student that after a few weeks, he was so thinking about his leg, he actually found it hard to walk. Because, you know, it is. It's true, like in physical health, it works like that, right? When do you feel an organ in your body?
When it hurts.
When it hurts, exactly, right? So the verse is also true. If you keep thinking about it, it'll start hurting, right? That's what it is. Because the obsession of self brings a degeneration of us entering into that self prison, and all that help, then everything is dysregulated and everything just becomes a mess. So that's where things. Now, this is why I end with another chapter in the book, another part of that chapter, which is beautiful. I just want to share a couple of ideas with you. First of all, you've heard me mention a person that I knew. He was an old Hasidic Jew, and his name was Reb Mendel Futterfass. I've mentioned him a number of times. And he was a person that went through unimaginable trauma. He was arrested. He grew up under communist Russia. He was then arrested. He was sent to Siberia. He spent 10 years there under the harshest of circumstances. It wasn't a five-star hotel, apparently, but it was really, really bad. And then eventually, and he was away from his family, he was completely lonely. His family managed to make it out to England. He was completely isolated. They cut off all communication. He was there for 10 years. And then he eventually made it out. Unfortunately, soon after he came out, his daughter was killed in a car accident. And he lived a rough life. And he was the happiest person I've ever seen. Not through denial. He was a very solid person, very healthy person, and a very intelligent person. He was a mentor in a yeshiva in Israel, in Kfar Chabad. My brother, who learned there, learned under him, and always would talk about him and his Fabrangians and his wonderful insights that he would share and so on. And he was just an amazing human being. Happy, always happy, happy to serve God, happy to be a Jew, and just happy in general. He was just unbelievably, what they call in Yiddish, freilach. And I often think about what it is, right? And there's different aspects of his life, and I've told you a story about the tightrope walker before and so on. But I think one aspect that we haven't highlighted about him is this. I never told you the story of why he got arrested in the first place and why he was put in Siberia for 10 years. Right? He was the most selfless human being ever. And one of the things he got involved in Russia under the really, really harsh times in when just the Jews were suffering tremendously there. There was a time, and I've forgotten which year it was, but there was a time that there was an opportunity to smuggle people out of Russia, involving also falsifying documents and all that kind of stuff. And he got very involved in that to try and get people out. And he got hundreds of people out of Russia that way, who eventually made it to Israel, to America, to France, to other places. And he had the opportunity to do it himself. And he said, and asked him what, and he said, he sent his family out that way, actually. That's how his family got out. But he didn't go out himself. He said, I'm not going until the last person I know has a way to get out. And at the very end, he got caught. Right? So he got caught because of his absolute selflessness, which is sad. But at the same time, you see how selflessness brings happiness. He never broke. He never broke. I think part of the reason is because his entire being was about doing for others, which is amazing. Not that he didn't take care of himself. He did. He was a very healthy person. But his mindset, why am I here? Why do I exist? For meaning and purpose. And part of that meaning and purpose is to help others, to give. Because as we said before, Olam Chesed Yibana. The world was founded on kindness. The world was founded on giving. I was reflecting just a couple of days ago, this past Monday. Many of you knew her. This past Monday was my mother's second yard site. So I was reflecting, you know, as you do on a yard site. And my mother was a person, many of you met her, she was a person who just had an amazing love of life. She had an amazing attitude, even when she suffered tragedy. She was just amazing. And until, I would say, 2 years before she passed away almost at 88, she was vibrant, she was always positive, she was always making jokes and always just loving life. She used to love to come here, we used to make fun of her that she has the FOMO of a teenager, right? This is a family line, right? That she couldn't miss anything out. She came here, she had to come to every shir, she had to come to every service in the shul. She couldn't miss out anything, just loved everything. And always, you know, I once asked a very simple line. I said, how do you do it? Because at that time when she was still like that, she'd suffered two significant tragedies. My older brother passed away and my niece passed away. So, and she was just amazing. And I asked her, like, how do you do this? So in her simplified way, she told me, what do you want me to do? To sit in the corner and mope? That's how she used to say, right? So I love life, and she used to have this expression she learned from her mother, that the lebedika leben, as she said, that those who are alive have to continue to live. That was the line, right? But then I realized, I was thinking about it the other day, and I realized that's not so simple, actually. Because there was a strategy she had. What she did was she kept on giving until she was really, like, even when she was ill. She had this, she used to entertain. Like, my father passed away 15 years ago. And she insisted on continuing to entertain. She loved guests. She would give. She would entertain. I realized when I visited her last year a number of times in South Africa, she had this whole following of young people who looked after her. She was like 86 and she was like mentoring these like young people. She loved them. She used to come visit her. Like every time they would come visit every few weeks. I mean, I still have correspondence with some of them. It's like amazing, right? And then she had the shiur that she started. It was very funny because it was a shiur that she started for elderly women. She started when she was like 60 or 55 or something. And it kept going until literally a year before she passed away, right? Adele's mother used to go, that's right. So she'd always talk about my old ladies. She was already 86, but she used to talk about my old ladies, right? In fact, just a reflection of the other day, unfortunately I lost this WhatsApp because by something happened to my father, but I used to treasure this WhatsApp. When she became quite ill, actually, and she was not mobile, and she had carers and everything like that, but she's still a couple of ladies that come every Monday morning, and they would learn a bit, and they would schmooze, and they would eat cake. And anyway, she had this is just a nice story that I'm telling you, but nothing to do with the topic. But we were very worried because she had a real sugar issue towards the end of her life, and she liked cake. She liked nuts. She was like, so I told the carers to take some people used to bring things, and they used to not understand that they used to bring cake. So we told the carers to get rid of the cake because it was really dangerous for her. It really was. She was insulin. It was like, anyway, I get this text one night. My mother, she's got all these WhatsApps, which each WhatsApp would take a long time to write. She said, she's calling Michaeli. She says, Michaeli, I am livid. Please stop running my life from abroad. Today, I didn't have cake to give my old ladies. She gave a whole mapola. Anyway, I mean, it was funny, that's the truth. And I treasured the WhatsApp a long time. But anyway, we worked it out somehow. But anyway, so it's giving. We need to be involved in giving. Had she been, when she got ill, my mother was a person who took care of herself. She always kept a doctor's appointment. She made sure to take care of herself properly. But she wasn't thinking about herself for days. She never thought about herself. She thought about what giving to other people. She was in with the young people, entertaining, giving her share. It all revolved around that. She used to run plays in the primary school, Torah Academy Primary School. But she was running them still when she was 80 years old. She was still running these yearly productions because she loved to give. And I think that's what the secret is. That's what we need to do. We need to think about others. We need to think less of ourselves and more about others. I wanna share with you an insight that's connected to this, right? That comes from this week's parsha, this week's weekly parsha, which I read just a few days ago. I think it's a beautiful idea, and I'm going to share it with you. I'm paraphrasing it a bit, but it comes from a commentary in the Torah called the Kli Yakar, which is Reb Shlomo Ephraim Lunchitz. He was born in the 16th century and passed away in the 17th century. He was a student of the great Maharal of Prague. In this week's parasha, you know, God tells Abraham the famous story, Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha, go from your land, from your birthplace, from your father's home, and go to a land that I'm going to show you. Essentially, that was one of the tests of Abraham Avinu. It's the first time we find detail about Abraham's story. God tells him to go to a destination, to go to the land of Israel, and he will make him a great nation, and so on and so forth. So there's so much written on that verse. And the Kli Yakar says, what's this idea? You have to go away from your birthplace, from your land, from your birthplace, and from your father's home. What's the idea? What's the idea of these three things? Why don't you just tell him to go to Israel? And also, what's the phrase, Lech Lecha? In Hebrew, if you literally translate the word Lech Lecha, it means go to you, right? Rashi says that it means go for your benefit, but he says, okay, it's good, but it doesn't explain the lacha. Lech lacha means go to you. What do you mean go to you? Go to Israel, not go to you. All right. So he says the following, and I think it's very interesting. We grow up and we're influenced by different things, and there are different things that form our identity, right? And we become dependent on different things. And he breaks them up into three things. The sort of, not egocentric, but the almost the selfish, the sense of self, put it that way, is developed and comes from three things. He says, first of all, it comes from the sort of the city you live in, because that's where people know you, that's where your reputation is, kind of thing, right? The next thing that a person is developed by is by the support of his family, like his birthplace, which he translates more as sort of family, relatives. You know, when you need something, they come, they help you, and so on and so forth. That's where you developed. And of course, a person is developed and supported emotionally and financially by their parents' home, right? Now, God says you have to go away from these things. You have to disconnect from these things. Now, not that they're bad things. But listen to this carefully. Not that they're bad things. Why? Because God promises exactly the same three things when Abraham lands in Israel. He says, when you go there, you will have a good reputation. I'll make you into a big family. You'll have a family of your own. And I will provide sustenance and finance for you. Right? So all the things that he told him to disconnect from, he will give back to him. So why do you have disconnected from? So here's the answer. The answer is Lech Lecha. God says, you have to do that because part of this journey, not just geographically, but part of this journey, spiritually speaking, is the need for every person to grow. And how do you grow? Lech Lecha. You actually have to go to yourself. Now, let's define that self. Not the self that people talk about today, my feelings, am I this, am I that, right? Or what people call today my authentic self, which I've never been able to figure out exactly what that means, right? It means they just decide who they are, and that's the authentic self, which is a bad thing to do because, no, we don't have an authentic self. Self is an egocentric being. We have to move away from self. But we do have a real self, and that self is the soul, right? The godly spark that we have. And in fact, as we've talked about many times, that's a soul that is everything other than self. The soul, which is an infusion of godliness, the soul, which is a godly spark, the soul, that which is that spark that God gave us, which is infinite and divine, gives us the ability to grow. In other words, gives us the ability to go beyond ourselves, gives us the ability of selflessness. That's what it is. Lech lecha, to discover your true self, not your, again, we have different selves. That's why, you know, I always talk about, people say, I've got to trust my gut. That's not necessarily true, because you don't know where it's coming from. We have a very, very big selfish self. That's our conscious self. Our conscious self is very egocentric, and that's how we're born. But we also have a true and deep self, which is our soul, our sense of meaning, the spark that Viktor Frankl talked about that gives us a DNA of needing to live a life of meaning and purpose. It gives us that ability to go beyond ourselves, to grow beyond our comfort zone, and to go out of ourselves and truly with authenticity to give to other people. That's what it is. And God says, you know what? You're not going to discover it here. Because here you're too trapped. You're too trapped in the superficiality of how you developed yourself. You've lived a whole life where your self has been built, your other self, your ego self, has been built and developed. You're not selfish, but yourself, the way it was born, was developed by the family, by your parents' home, by your support, by outside support. And therefore it's blocked you and you haven't actually been able to discover your real self. So you need to disconnect from that city, from the reputation that has been given to you. You need to disconnect from even the support of your family, which is a good thing. You need to disconnect even from your parents' home. In other words, from that which you think, doesn't always mean a person has to do that. It means you have to disconnect from the identity that you think you were given, which actually does not come from your true inner self, but comes from things outside of you. And you got to go and lech lecha and discover your real self. Discover your selfless self. Discover yourself of purpose and meaning. Once you've done that, and that if that becomes your foundation, then I'm going to give you back all those three things. Because all the three things are good. They're not bad things. It's not bad to have support. It's not bad to have a reputation. It's not bad to be supported emotionally, physically, financially, in whichever way. We talked about it before. It's very important, in fact. It's important because it's part of giving and receiving. But when it's there, but it doesn't connect to the real self, it doesn't connect to the sense of giving and the sense of selflessness and the sense of meaning and purpose, it just becomes an egocentric thing. We become dependent on the identity that others give us. We don't have a true identity. We don't have true meaning and purpose. And we're just trying to take more and more just to feed that fragile self that we've built through what other people have given us and not what we've built through our own true meaning and purpose. So therefore, says God, disconnect from all those things. Go discover who you really are. Give that to your nation. Give that to your children. That will be the neshama. That will be the soul of being able to go higher than yourself. And then you do that in the context of I'm giving to give back that reputation and support. Those are all good things, but you'll take them differently and you understand them differently. You'll understand them and develop them in the context of the purpose and meaning of life.
Yeah. But when was the name changed?
Later, only after. Later. Yeah, yeah. You have to have Lech Lecha first. You have to disconnect first in order to get that new name. Yeah. Because that's when you became a true giver. I said, up until then, he was just a big macher in Aram, Avram, which Rashi says he was in the place where he was. But now you're going to be the leader of generations. Avraham, that's Amon Goyim. You can be leader of the father of many nations. Yeah. Just finish up, going back to the book, just finish up with a beautiful story, which I think I mentioned once, but I'm going to say it again anyways, but because it's about constant giving. And it's cute. I'm reading these stories about people that I know. Oh, I knew, I should say. So there was a woman called Mrs. Taibel Lipska. I knew her because, I knew her in a funny way, because when I got married, she was an older lady in Kralaitz, an old Russian lady, very, very smart person. And somehow, after I was learning in Kollel in Kralaitz in Brooklyn, and somehow I got roped into giving a weekly women's shiur in 770. I'm not sure how. I don't remember how now. I just remember it was very good. The only thing I remember was that it was very good only because I used to give it in Yiddish, actually, this year. These were all women that spoke Yiddish. And it was really good only because Dina's grandmother, who I just got to know, she became my Bobby, she had such nachas because she wouldn't miss a shiur. She used to come and then I used to walk her home afterwards and she loved it. So I was happy to be able to give her that. But anyway, and one part of the shiur sometimes I think it was on a Monday night or something like that, I would repeat some of the ideas that the Rebbe had spoken about on Shabbos. And I remember once that I spoke, it was about a particular Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, in Ethics of the Fathers, and it was from Rabbi Lazar ben Azaria, famous, who we also quote in the Haggadah. And they were very, I had to be on my guard. I had to make sure that I knew what I was talking about, because these are actually very learned and very smart women. I started off and I was saying that the Rebbe quoted the Mishnah, and by mistake I misquoted and I said Rabbi Eliezer, because there's actually two Talmudic sages. One is Rabbi Eliezer, one is Rabbi Lazar. In a flash, I hear this strong voice, Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah. It was Mrs. Leibovitz. Anyway, she was a strong woman, she was a great woman. So what's the story? The story was that she came from Russia. She then, one of the Russian immigrants who came to Brooklyn. You know, Russia had a lot of Hasidim from the Chabad movement, and they came. And life as an immigrant wasn't easy. Eventually she got married, but Parnassa was tough. Everything was really, really tough. And she wrote to the Rebbe once that she's really doing a tap, but she doesn't know what to do. So apparently, the Rebbe must have known this, but apparently she was a young woman then, and she knew how to dance really, really well. So the Rebbe said, this is my advice, go to as many weddings as possible and dance to inspire other people, and inspire other people to dance as well. Okay, the Rebbe says, that's what you do. She didn't understand what it had to do with her problem. So she went. Now in those days, it was early on in Brooklyn. A lot of younger people who were getting married actually didn't have a large family, or even parents sometimes, to help them make the wedding really friendly, because a lot of people had died in the Holocaust. I mean, this was a broken community in the 1950s, right? So she had this thing, she would go to weddings, all weddings, invited not, or not invited. She would go, the Rebbe told her to go to every wedding. And
she had a free ticket.
Yeah, she just went to every wedding. And I mean, you know, there were lots of weddings those days. I mean, even more now, but... And she used to get in the circle and just rev it up. She was an amazing dancer, apparently. And just used to make it like really, really frail, like really, really happy. Was that just, and just give that joy to others, right? But here's the interesting part of the story. Another lady, Mrs. Dyche, she was much younger, who was a young girl then, was born in Worcester and had come to study, go to school in Crown Heights. And she was upset. She was really like... She was not happy. You know, you move schools, especially when you're a teenager. She didn't have a lot of friends. She didn't know. She was just alone. And one night, she says, I was at a wedding. And I was really upset because I didn't know the dances. I didn't know the speed and the noise of the from religious Hasidic weddings. All new to me. I couldn't keep up, so I didn't even try. And she tells the story. Suddenly, this older woman, this whirlwind dancer, grabbed my two hands with her two hands and pulled me into the center of the circle. I tried to pull away and explain, I'm from Worcester. I don't dance, but she couldn't hear me anyway. And she had me with an iron grip, so I took my only option, other than to faint. I danced, right? It would be not an exaggeration to say that I had more fun in that one dance than I ever had in my whole life until that point. She whirled me around. She flipped me this way and that way, and I just followed her lead. Since I had absolutely zero choice in the matter, remember, iron grip. After it was over, she asked me my name. I was too shy to ask her name. But later, someone told me that it was Mrs. Tybel Lipska. Right? So in other words, the Rebbe told her to fix her own problem she needed to give, and she ended up helping someone else by doing that. She ended up taking a young girl who was really not happy and not upbeat and was having a lot of challenges and struggle, and just lifted her spirits, and it was a turning point for her as well. And she writes about it in articles that she's a journalist. She runs a magazine today, and she writes articles, and she wrote this article about herself. So the point and the takeaway is that the first key that we're going to learn about, we're going to learn lots of different things, but the first key to inner health and resilience is opening up our mind and knowing to think a little bit less about ourselves whenever we can, and to think about what we can do for others. Have a wonderful week. More next week.